Have you ever wondered how a book becomes a movie?
Or how a movie becomes a musical?
Or how anything is adapted at all?
Join us as we talk about your favorite stories and all the changes that were made along the way.
But more importantly, why? This is Willing to Adapt. Hi, welcome back to Willing to Adapt. This is Eric Von Crumley.
And I'm Romy Reyes.
This is the third season for our podcast.
That it is.
How's that feel?
Feels good.
Feels like it's been a long time.
It has been.
Well, thank you for all of our listeners out there. We really appreciate you keeping up with us. And for newer listeners who randomly started with this episode because you saw what we were talking about, welcome.
Hopefully you can go back and listen to some of our other stuff.
Yeah.
Sometimes some of it might be a little more raw when we were first starting out.
Yeah.
But with time, we've hopefully gotten a little bit better.
The sound quality's gotten better.
That it has. And
yeah.
And we, once again, I'm very grateful to those who have helped us make that happen.
All right. Do you want to tell our listeners what we're talking about?
We're talking about The Unfortunate Children.
You always say that. You always say that.
It's, okay, let me see if I can remember the whole name. It's Lemony Snicket's...
Are you actually sincere right now?
I'm actually sincere.
Oh, geez.
Children of Unfortunate Events or something?
Lemony Snicket's a series of unfortunate events. Yes.
Okay.
Rolls right off the tongue.
Yes, it does.
Got it. Okay, let me jump right in here real quick and give a very brief statement. A Series of Unfortunate Events is a series of 13 children novels written by American author Daniel Handler under the pen name Lemony Snicket. The books follow the turbulent lives of orphaned siblings Violet, Klaus, and Sunny Baudelaire. After their parents' death in a fire, the children are placed in the custody of a murderous villain, Count Olaf, who attempts to steal their inheritance and causes numerous disasters with the help of his accomplices as the children attempt to flee. As the plot progresses, the Baudelaires gradually confront further mysteries surrounding their family and deep conspiracies involving a secret society called VFD, which also involves Olaf and Snicket, the author's own fictional self-insert. The books were published between 1999 and 2006, and they've had a couple of different adaptations. They had the movie in 2004, which we will be talking about, and they had a video game, which we will not be talking about.
What? There's a video game?
There's a video game. There's actually a board game, too.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And then the 2014? 17?
Something like that. Netflix series?
Yes, the Netflix series.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Romy, when was the first time you read any of these books?
For this podcast.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was.
Yes. Hey, I've been aware of them.
If I had a quarter every time.
I know. For the sake of the podcast.
For the sake of the podcast.
His cry was for the sake of the children. Mine's for the sake of
the
podcast.
For the sake of the children.
Yes.
It sounds like Finding Nemo when he has to go through the Ring of Fire. Isn't there another way? He's just a boy.
Yeah, no, this is the first time. So I have been aware of them.
It'd be difficult to not be aware of them.
Well,
I mean, you had a daughter.
I did, and that's the only reason I was really aware of them. I want to say, because it was 99, I don't remember.
Well, they weren't super popular when they first came out. It kind of grew.
Okay, that explains a lot. Because I don't remember them. Like, I was...
Yeah. It's not like Harry Potter, where it was published and immediately
exactly.
The world loved it.
And that's... So the Harry Potter is the only... This is children's lit, not...
Children, young adult,
young adult.
Yes. So, children and young adult.
Okay, so what's the difference between young adult and children, or is there no
difference?
I think
it's just the age group is geared towards... Because for this one, it's 13 books, so you're growing up with the books. So I think the idea is he wrote them knowing that the children were going to grow up with the books.
Like
so he wrote,
J.K. Rowling did.
So he purposefully wrote the later books in a way that would be much more psychological and a bit more ethically ambiguous, morally confusing, so on.
Okay.
He asks a lot of questions that an older reader would be able to maybe think about and grasp.
Okay. And just for the record, I think you might have said this already. We only read the first three.
No, I did not say this.
Okay, so.
So I've read all the books.
I've read
all the books at least twice.
Wow.
I think for this podcast, this is the I read the first three for the third time.
Okay.
But I actually listened to them this time. Because if you find the original CDs, like the audio books, not the new ones, because the new ones that they have based off the TV show, with all the branding from the TV show, those are narrated by Daniel Handler, who's Lemony Snicket.
Oh, okay.
So it's kind of cool because it's him. Mm-hmm. But the audiobooks, the original ones that actually are like for the books from way back when, do you know who narrates them?
No.
It's Tim Curry.
But yeah, okay.
Isn't that just perfect, though?
That is.
Can you imagine Tim Curry just narrating these books?
That would be cool to listen to.
They're so good.
Oh.
Okay. The books, according to Wikipedia, are characterized by Victorian Gothic tones and absurdist textuality. The books are noted for their dark humor, sarcastic storytelling, and anachronistic elements. A word here which means pieces that do not fit within each time period.
Uh-huh.
As well as frequent cultural and literary allusions. They've been classified as postmodern and metafictional writing, with the plot evolution throughout the later novels being cited as an exploration of the psychological process of the transition from the innocence of childhood to the moral complexity of maturity.
Hmm.
As the series progresses, the Baudelaires must face the reality that their actions have become morally ambiguous, blurring the lines between which characters should be read as good or evil. And, like I said, since they were first published, they've just grown significantly in popularity until they become a phenomenon.
Interesting.
Yep.
I guess I'm not part of the young adult children phenomenon world anymore.
Well, I'm not really either. Handler acknowledged that for these books, among his influences were Roald Dahl and Edward Gorey.
I don't know who that is.
He was an illustrator and book writer in the 20th century.
Okay.
Edward Gorey has a very specific style, and he's influenced a lot of people, kind of including Tim Burton.
I think I know what you're talking about, because my mom used to watch a lot of that
stuff. Yeah, he has a very specific style. A lot of his stuff looks like it's supposed to be set either in the Edwardian era or in the 20s and 30s. He has a book called, The Ghastly Crumb Tinnies? I can't remember what it is. He has a lot of dark stuff, I'll just say that. He's really dark.
Okay.
He has a book where it's like all the letters of the alphabet, and it's like all the different ways that these children have died.
Oh.
Yeah.
Charming.
I know. Yeah, he's a prevalent name, that's why.
Okay. I probably have come across this stuff and seen it and just didn't realize it.
Probably.
Yeah.
So, since this was the first time that you read the first three books, what did you think? I know that you're older.
Correct.
But what did you think?
I'm hoping when you say that, you mean I'm an adult.
Yes.
And so
I think there's a lot in the books that adults can enjoy too, but I know it's not the target audience.
Correct. And they were a slog to get through.
Were they?
They were so hard to get through.
Okay, tell me why. Tell me why.
I found them boring.
Okay, why?
Slow.
Yeah.
Super slow.
Well, I hear you.
And it was very hard to get. I think the whole bit that you just did got a little old after a while.
Yeah.
And so, as we will talk about later, the difference between the show and even the movie and this, the books, I read somewhere that it's not until a little later the lore starts coming out. And so at this point, I felt like I was just reading a kind of a repetitive story. So because of that, there's a part of me that kind of would like to continue reading them to get the whole series as a completionist, but I don't know if I would be willing to put the time unless it was for this podcast.
I think we should say real quick, the reason that we are specifically talking about the first three books only for this, we will discuss very cursory the other books, because I'll explain some things to you, and there'll be a little bit of spoilers.
I read Wikipedia's version. Yeah, okay.
The reason why we're talking about the first three is because this is a difficult episode to discuss, because one of the adaptations, the film adaptation, is about only the first three.
Correct.
And then the TV show has all the books.
Correct, yeah.
So it just seemed for the best that we should just cover the first three.
No, I agreed.
So this is a little different than what we usually do, but it's the same vein. I agree with you, because this time around when I was reading and listening to the books, I definitely did not enjoy them as much as I did as a kid. This was one of those books that I can't remember when I first picked it up. I just remember reading them. I just remember already being ingrained in the books.
Okay.
So I don't know if I saw someone reading them and then I went and picked it up.
And you don't remember how old you were?
I only remember being in middle school when I was reading them, which makes sense because the movie, I had already read at least the first three by the time the movie came out. So I knew all that would happen.
Okay.
And I remember the movie came out in 2004. So I would have been 11.
Okay.
And you would have been 30.
Not that old. 2004?
Yeah.
I was in my mid-20s, maybe.
Yeah. I do remember watching the movie because I remember really wanting to see the movie because I read the books. And so I remember watching the movie in theaters.
Mm-hmm.
But even though I had read the books, I really fell in love with the film.
Okay.
And we'll talk more about that. Mm-hmm. But this is one of those times where you would think if you read the books, you might not like the film. But I did really love the film. And to this day, I still love the film.
Yeah.
So the books are really intriguing because I have not been able to find anywhere that explicitly says if Daniel Handler... Do you want to just say Lemony Snicket or Daniel Handler?
I think we could do Lemony Snicket.
Do you want to say Lemony Snicket when it's in universe and Daniel Handler when it's in ours?
Sure.
Okay. I'm just trying to make sense of this, you know? So we'll do that. So I couldn't find anything specific where Daniel Handler had said if he intended to infuse as much of VFD, which is the secret organization, as early in the books and then to slowly reveal them, or if he had the idea but didn't know what he wanted to do with it and then just slowly infused it into the books. Because that's what it feels like to me.
Yeah.
Because it's not until you get into book 6 that you really start to uncover things.
Okay.
Like, there's hints.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I think he knew he wanted to go that way, but he didn't want to jump into it.
Yeah.
And then I think as soon as he knew what he wanted to do, he just ran with it.
Mm.
And because there are auxiliary books in the universe, one of them I have right here.
Yep.
The Unauthorized Autobiography of Lemony Snicket, which is kind of a tell-all without being a tell-all.
Okay.
It's actually very well done. I'll let you peruse it.
Okay.
But if you read the books, it actually explains some things from the books.
Okay.
And in that, it does explain something behind the scenes information in regards to the first few books. And so it does insinuate that a lot of VFD stuff was happening. I also am wondering if he wrote them in a way that it was supposed to be specifically from the children's point of view. And so they would not have been aware.
See, I did read that somewhere. I did do some research.
Yeah.
And I can't remember where I came across it. And someone had posted something. But yeah, go ahead.
So the first book, the children find out that their parents have perished in a terrible fire that destroys their mansion. And then sent to live with their closest relative, which the banker, Mr. Poe, who takes charge of them, took as close in proximity. And so he takes them to Count Olaf, who we're pretty sure they're not actually related to.
Yeah.
And Count Olaf in the book is just pure evil, like malicious and abusive and conniving. And he's an actor and he has an acting troupe and they're all very terrible as well. And they're almost like stock characters in a way, in that they're more described by how they look and not by name. So there's like the two powdered-faced women, and then there's the bald man, the man with hooks for hands, and then there's the person who is either a man or a woman, but we're not sure.
Yeah, I remember that.
And that one's always fun to see how they adapt. Because in the books, when he writes, the character of Lemony Snicket writes it as if the person who is either a man or a woman, it's just like they're not sure if they're one or the other, and it's impolite to ask.
Yeah. I found that quote. It was, the books are more linear, told strictly from the Baudelaire's point of view with Snicket's narrations as asides. That's the book, yeah.
There you go. Yeah, I do think there is truth to that.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you start looking at some of the auxiliary books, like the Unauthorized Autobiography, and then there's the Beatrice Letters, and then he ended up coming out with a prequel book. There's like two books, I think.
Interesting.
Called All the Wrong Questions. And it's in universe. And it's supposed to be Snicket's childhood.
Oh, okay.
And I have the first one. And I haven't started reading it yet. But I want to.
Okay.
But it's one of those things where when you look at some of the other books, like these auxiliary books, it makes it sound like there was a lot going on.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you actually read those books, it seems like it wasn't really happening.
When you read the original
books. I'll explain real quick here.
Go ahead.
So, in the first book, the children go to live with Count Olaf, and I'm going to just sum it up real quick. At the end of the first book, he tries to trick them in getting their fortune from them by marrying Violet. And the idea is that because he is acting in loco parentis, a Latin word which means acting as a parent.
Acting, yeah.
He is able to marry Violet even though she's 14 years old because he is her guardian and he gives permission. And so he's trying to trick her into marrying him in a play by having like the real Justice of the Peace, Justice Strauss, come and perform the marriage for the play and everything. And he basically threatens to kill Sunny if she doesn't. But in a clever turn of events, Violet does not write her name in her own hand because she wrote it with her left hand.
That was interesting.
The logic of the books is always astounding. I'll just say that. Yes. It's very much not meant to be taken as reality. It's almost like it. Well, I think people best described it as an alternate universe. Because there are real situations and places and events that are described, mm-hmm. and people and musicians and things and places, but then they're just slightly wrong.
Correct.
Like, yeah. There's a character known as the Duchess of Winnipeg, but there is no Duchess of Winnipeg, and there never really has been. Yes, it's later on.
Okay.
Yeah. But anyway.
But it adds to the absurdity of
it. It does. Yeah. And it adds to the imagination, and you're never really knowing where and when. And even like in some of the illustrations by Brett Hellquist, which I really love, like it gives you an impression that some of it feels very Edwardian, but some of it feels very 30s. I think generally it fits between the Edwardian period and the 40s.
Hmm.
But it's very loose.
Yeah.
So then, of course, that plot fails. So then the children are sent to live with their uncle Monty, who is a herpetologist, which means...
someone who studies herps.
Snakes.
Herpes.
Yep. I think it was maybe in the TV show where they say it has nothing to do with sores or something.
Yes, I do remember that scene.
Yes. And I was like, ew. Yes, he studies snakes and reptiles. And in that one, Count Olaf appears right before the children are supposed to go to Peru with their uncle. And he appears as Uncle Monty's new assistant. And of course, he kills Uncle Monty. Mm-hmm. And he tries to take the children away. But then at the last minute, the children are able to outsmart him. And the hook-handed man, who was pretending to be a doctor.
Yeah.
And so then they get away.
Or the coroner, I think is what it was.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And then in the third one, the children go to live with their Aunt Josephine at Lake Lacrimose on her house that's precariously perched atop of the hill over the lake.
I think that was probably the one I disliked the most.
Really?
Not disliked, but didn't enjoy it as much as the other two.
Sure.
I like Dr. Montgomery.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But then... she is deathly afraid of everything.
Yeah.
And what I thought was interesting in the book is that it hints that she's just always been afraid of things in the books.
Yes.
Which I thought was intriguing.
Mm-hmm.
And she, of course, encounters Count Olaf, who pretends to be a sailor named
Captain Sham.
Sham. And she starts to... Did you just get that?
I actually did not catch on to that till right now.
Oh.
That is funny. I must have been tired.
Yep. It's like so on the nose you didn't catch it.
It was.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that he writes that are like really specific and really interesting when you know the meaning of them. So what ends up happening in The Wide Window, which is the third book, is Captain Sham convinces Aunt Josephine to write a suicide note. And I think it hints that... she pretends to jump out the window, or that he was going to. It's a little vague.
It was very vague.
It's vague in the book.
It took me a minute to figure out.
Yeah. But either way, she's not actually dead.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
And you find out, because she loves grammar so much, the children are able to find out that in her suicide note, there's a bunch of grammatical mistakes. And so they realize it's a secret message saying where she is.
Yeah.
So then the children go to find her. But then at the last moment, they lose her when Count Olaf appears, and she ends up being eaten by the leeches in the lake because these are terrible leeches.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, you know, the children outwit Count Olaf again, and they leave, and it goes on to the next book. And, you know, that's the gist of it. Yeah, there's a whole lot, obviously, more to it than that, but that's the gist of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that's all we need to know for the movie, at least.
Correct.
But... Yeah, I think some people have criticized the books, especially some of the later books, as being too formulaic. It's like the children get in trouble, Count Olaf shows up, and then they outwit him.
That's what I was afraid of. That's why part when I made this, the comment about not really wanting to give the time, because I'll be honest, I probably will finish the series eventually. I don't know if I'll do it right now.
I would encourage you to finish the series.
Series or the books? Sorry, I will probably finish the Netflix series.
Got it. Okay, if maybe watch the Netflix show and finish the Netflix show, because I think it's more approachable.
Okay.
But then if it encourages you to go back and read the books, then go back and read the books, because there's more in the books.
Okay.
And I will say this, because we'll talk about the series when we get to it, but the way that the series plays out is very different than how the books play out. But they are very close to the books, though. Like, in many ways, they are very close to the books. Okay. But they do a little bit of their own thing.
Because they add the lore in, that made it different for me. Mm-hmm. Whereas with the books, I think for me, it would be a slog to get through up until book six.
Yeah. I think because as adults, especially, we're very interested in that secret organization and the mysteries and what's happening. Whereas for children, when they start reading the first few books, they're more interested in how the kids overcome these things.
Correct. Yeah. And the other thing, too, with the book. Oh, so I did not buy these. I don't own them.
I assumed you wouldn't, because you don't tend to, so.
Actually, I think I own almost everything we've ever done a podcast on. Almost everything. Who did I not buy?
I don't think you bought The Outsiders.
That was the only one I did not. However, I remember I found my my high school copy.
There you go.
So for this one, I borrowed them from the library. I borrowed the e-books.
Ooh. E-books?
The e-books. So because, you know, I just haven't had a it's a little hard to find time to go to the library and get a copy. What is fascinating, and it made me wonder how popular these books still are.
I would say they're still moderately popular.
I would say they are. Yeah. It's so normally when I'm looking for a book, the wait time, it's not that bad. I had to wait weeks to get a copy of it. I want to say it was like,
you should have just borrowed my copies.
Now you tell me. Do you have the other books?
I have all the books.
I might borrow the other ones then. It might be easier to read it that way, because if I can read them at night, put me to sleep.
Yeah.
So there's kids out there, people out there who are still reading these. And
yeah, one, I think it's because we have the next generation.
Yeah.
So those who grew up with it are now giving it to the next generation.
Okay. And I tried listening to the audiobook, but it wasn't the Tim Curry one.
Oh, you had Daniel Handler then.
Yeah. It was fine, but I found that I missed...
He's very dry.
That's why. I missed information.
Yeah.
Because I think I listened to maybe the first two chapters of the first book on audio.
Yeah.
And then I went, because it was available. And so I went back and I got the e-copy and I started reading it. And I'm like, wait, what? And so I had to go back and reread and I just skimmed it. But I realized there was a couple little details I missed.
Mm-hmm.
I always push reading versus over audiobooks usually with people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. He seems like a big researcher.
Mm.
Like, he definitely seems like someone who puts a lot of thought into things.
Yeah. Yeah, that makes sense.
And weird things. Yeah. I really appreciate his world building, though. Like, he's got some great world building. And he leaves just enough to the imagination, which I think is fun.
Okay.
Yeah. So, you did not enjoy reading these books?
Not really. They were a slog, I'm not going to lie. Not that I hated them. And I'm not talking like, who's the guy I dislike? Dan Brown, horrible.
I know you don't like Dan Brown.
Yeah. It's not like that. It was more just, I knew I was reading a kid's book.
Yeah.
And that's why there's a slight pull in me to finish the series.
Sure.
But
I think they do get better.
Okay.
In my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
But I think obviously for me, there's a bit of nostalgia for it.
Yeah. I figured.
My biggest thing with the books this time around reading them, which was a little sad, is I found the book characters really flat. So I got really annoyed with them in the books. And I think it's because they depend upon specific characterizations in the books. Later on, though, of course, they grow and they become more nuanced. But yeah, but that was this time around for me.
Okay. And refresh my memory. I know you said this at the beginning. This was the first time you've read it since...
Oh, I listened to the first two on the audiobook, maybe within the last year.
Okay.
But when you're listening to Tim Curry talk, it's...
It's different.
It's different. But I hadn't read the books maybe since my underclassmen years of high school.
Okay.
Maybe a little earlier.
I'm trying to think for you what that, how far
book,
back that is.
Because the last book...
Because that's a lot further for me.
The last book is called The End, and it came out in 2006. So I was in middle school.
Okay.
And I know that I read it exactly after it came out. And I also remember that The Beatrice Letters, which is another auxiliary book, came out my eighth grade year.
Have you read that one?
I have, and I do own it.
Okay.
It's also interesting. It expands a little bit and explains some things, but also makes things more confusing.
Oh, wow.
He doesn't like to just tell you things.
Yeah, I figure.
Yeah, but that one was really fun. I remember I was taking a plane to stay with my uncle in Colorado, and at the airport, I found the Beatrice Letters, and I bought it, and I read it on the plane. And it's one of those where it's like, he likes to do these things in his books, his auxiliary books especially, where you have to piece some of the mystery together yourself. And so at the end of the Beatrice Letters, it does tell you the fate of the Baudelaire children, but it tells you the fate in a way that doesn't really tell you the fate. So like it gives you information, but it doesn't tell you enough.
Yeah.
And so that's been one of the questions of many people forever, is like what ends up happening to the Baudelaire children?
Okay.
Because he never spells it out. And from what I've come across in writings and things like that, is it almost sounds like even Daniel Handler never really knew what happened to them.
Okay.
And I don't know if that's him being coy or if he actually just never knew and just doesn't care to figure it out.
It's possible. I've heard a lot of authors when they're writing, many of them have different processes. And some of them, like I was listening to a mystery writer who she was saying how she, for one of her books once, she decided she would try it and not know who the killer was and try to solve it as she was writing it. And then I've heard others who...
That involves a lot of editing after, I'm sure.
Yeah, I'm sure it did. And then I heard another guy once talk about something similar where he was writing as if he was writing as a journalist for a snippet of someone's life. So he doesn't know a lot about the beginning or a lot about the end.
Got it.
So it's kind of a weird way of looking at it, but I think for this series, this book, it seems to work.
Well, what's interesting is there's so much to talk about. Like, we could have a whole podcast just devoted to everything by Lemony Snicket. The lore, the books,
yeah,
everything. Like, it literally could be its own podcast because there's just so much to talk about.
I'm sure.
Especially if you start talking about the adaptations. But VFD is the secret organization that you learn about in A Series of Unfortunate Events. And the anytime you come across something in the books with the initials VFD, you know it's supposed to be connected to them somehow.
Okay.
But sometimes it's not.
Oh.
It becomes a plot point in one of the later books.
Yeah.
In the Vile Village, I think it is. The children start to learn about VFD, so then they try to figure out more about it so they can uncover the secrets and stuff.
Yeah.
They try to figure out where they're going to go next when Mr. Poe's talking to them, and he tells them on the list, there's a place called VFD. And so they decide to go there. And when they get there, it's like the village of foul devotees. But it's like fowls and birds.
Yeah.
And so they get there and they're like, oh, this is actually nothing to do with VFD. Got it.
So red herrings, basically.
Yes. Of course, that doesn't stop the problems, but...
Yeah.
But in the books, and this is what's really complicated, because I was telling you this, when you talk about A Series of Unfortunate Events, you have to be very specific about what you're talking about. Because when you talk to people, it's... Are you referring to the book series? Are you referring to the movie? Or are you referring to the TV show?
Okay.
Because they all do their own things, and they change. They change the timeline, and they change what VFD means, and they change like when things and they change characterizations and stuff. So what one ending might be in one is not the other, and so it gets a little complicated.
As a geek, I fully understand that.
And so I think most people obviously consider the books more canon because they're the original, but then it just depends on who you're talking to.
Yeah. Almost every franchise who has been made into a book, been made into a movie has experiences that issues.
Yes. But yeah, in the books, VFD, there's a lot of mystery that surrounds it, and it's on purpose.
Okay.
So Daniel Handler as Lemony Snicket, you find out that Lemony Snicket is a part of VFD.
Okay, yes. Because of the series, there's a lot of connections I've made.
Yeah.
The Netflix series, sorry.
Yeah, and so in the books, VFD, you get the impression that the original name for it was Volunteer Fire Department.
Okay.
And so it's one of those things where you get the idea from the books that it started off as a literal fire department, like volunteer fire department, that would fight real fires. But then over time, it became more of a figurative volunteer fire department. And so they started extinguishing figurative fires. And so they would go out and try to prevent figurative fires. So that would involve like any sort of evil.
Okay.
Or things like that.
Okay.
And so in the books, VFD is for all intents and purposes the good guys, but then later on into the books, it also becomes very ambiguous. You find out there was this big schism. They literally call it the Great Schism within VFD.
Yeah, I read about that.
And it's very complicated on where in the timeline it happened.
Okay.
But the idea is that Olaf and then some other people later on were a part of VFD. But it gets really complicated to figure out, were they good and then they're part of the schism or like what happened? So it gets confusing because they don't explain it all.
Yeah.
And you just never get all the answers. But they end up looking for something called the Sugar Bowl. And you never fully figure out why they want the Sugar Bowl. Although later on it's heavily implied that it's an antidote to something.
Oh, okay.
I don't want to give too much away.
Yeah, I came across the Sugar Bowl reference.
Yeah, it becomes very important. Also because in the adaptations, they reference it a couple times.
Okay.
Like offhandedly. But so the tattoo of an eye that Count Olaf has on his ankle, you find out was an original way to find someone who was a part of VFD. Because according to the later books, especially the I actually is meant to look more like the letters VFD.
Oh, okay.
And it's just like a weird way of doing it. And I think it was just, there's a whole lot to it where it's like some of it's speculation.
Yeah.
But they stopped doing the tattoo after the schism.
Oh.
Because then you had people on both sides who had it. And so, yeah. And so there's a lot of mystery still. Like, to this day, nobody really knows why the Baudelaire mansion caught on fire and why the parents died. Or did the parents really die? Is one of them still alive? You know, there's a lot out there that's left unsaid.
Okay.
And on purpose.
Yeah.
And of course, it gets real confusing. But I'm going to give some backstory here for those who are interested. Some of this comes from the unauthorized autobiography. So the idea of VFD is it was a group of people who came together, essentially, and some of them were wealthy, so they're like helping to fund it, and so sometimes they had their headquarters was in a mansion, and sometimes they had to move headquarters, especially after the schism, and so at one point they ended up going underground, and it gets a little weird because I guess according to VFD, they will scout out children who show great talent and skills and what it might be a good asset to VFD, and essentially will kidnap them.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. But it's one of those things where like the parents might know it's coming. And so then it's almost like they're raising the children as part of VFD and like teaching them the lessons and things like that. That's why I said VFD ends up becoming a little morally ambiguous. It also gets really interesting because it also sounds like, to an extent, some people in the city are aware of VFD. Because when you read in some of the newspapers and stuff, they will say things like, this real life fire was put out without the help of any volunteers.
Referencing the organization.
Yeah. Okay. Or any volunteer fire department was not called or things like that. And so there's things like that where it's like, it seems like almost some people know about them, but you're not sure. But they live in the shadows and they kind of work behind the scenes. And so it gets a little complicated and it's like, are they really good, or are they trying to control the society, or are they a light in the world, or are they has their power gone to their head? And it gets a little complicated.
Okay.
But I think for, like I said, all intents and purposes, for the most part, VFD are the good guys. It's just, it gets a little complicated because people.
Yeah.
But that's all you really need to know to discuss some of the stuff in the adaptations.
Okay.
Other than that, you know, they had a headquarters, but in every adaptation, it's something else. It's somewhere else. So.
Oh, okay.
But yeah, so was there anything about the books you did like?
Like I said, they weren't unenjoyable.
They're just slow.
They were just slow. Yeah.
The first one definitely picks up near the end.
Yes, it does. And the second one I thought was probably the most enjoyable of the three. And Josephine, I just did not care about.
Yeah, and when we talk about the adaptations, you'll see how they kind of change her character.
Yeah. Yeah, they were both very different. And so overall, there had to have been something there to plant that desire, that weak desire to continue and finish reading it. So, and I think
I have to finish this, Eric, and I're going to record.
No, not, I mean the whole series, like to read all 13 books.
Got it.
So there was something where at the end I was kind of thinking to myself, maybe yeah. I should go and finish these. Maybe I should.
I will say once the children stop being passive mm-hmm. and become more active, the books become much more interesting.
Okay.
Because
maybe that's what it was.
Yeah, because that's what happens in the books. That's what the parts of the books that are the most interesting are when the children are actively working to do something.
Correct. Yeah.
I find in the books, especially mm-hmm. the first three, the children are very not passive in general, but mm-hmm. they don't do as much as I think they should have. Like mm-hmm. there's a lot of times where Count Olaf shows up and it's like, why are you kind of just going along with this? Like, yeah. why aren't you saying something?
Yeah.
Like, and obviously, like, Violet's supposed to be, like, 14. But I feel like at 14, you'd be saying something.
Yeah.
And so in the adaptations, they do change some of that.
Mm-hmm.
But there's definitely times I was reading the books this time where I was like, why are you doing this? Why are you just going along with this? Like,
yeah.
It seems like this could have been better, you know?
Yeah, I think it was just an oversimplistic writing, not writing, sorry, but an oversimplistic style.
A little.
And granted, it was for children, it's for kids. So I knew that while reading it.
Right.
Yeah. But it wasn't Harry Potter.
Yeah, I think what people have credited this Daniel Handler with the series, I think part of the what works in its favor.
Mm-hmm.
Is the fact that he uses reverse psychology on the reader.
Hmm.
He makes it very clear in the writing and on the book cover especially that he does not want people to read it.
Oh, yeah.
He's like, there are, and he tells them very straight up front, he's like, there is nothing happy about this. And yeah. So I think it works in his favor because every time you read the books or watch them, whatever it is, it ends up being sad. It ends up mm-hmm. being unhappy, essentially. Yep. Like, there's moments where things are fine, you know, and they're happy, but it ends up being really dark and mm-hmm. really sad and scary. But because you are warned about it
mm-hmm.
and like, blatantly told, don't read this, go read something else.
Yeah.
It pulls you in, but then it's also like, well, I chose to do this and I was warned, so, you know, so that works in its favor.
I'm going to be philosophical for a minute.
Please.
I'm not really drawn to nihilism
mm-hmm.
and to nihilistic type,
I know that.
Type stuff. So, like, I'm not a big fan of Seinfeld.
Oh, I hate Seinfeld.
There was a show in the Netflix Marvel days, Jessica Jones. Super nihilistic.
I know of it, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, I wouldn't recommend it.
Huh.
And so I felt like I was reading nihilism for children in a certain way.
Sure.
And so part of me was hoping that that his reverse psychology was a means of saying nothing good is ever going to happen, and in the end something good happens.
Well, I think that's what everybody hopes.
Yes.
I think everybody's hoping that, well, even though we were told nothing good happens, maybe something good will happen.
I know. So I had dinner with my daughter the other night.
Did she read these books?
She watched the Netflix series.
Got it.
Because she was in middle school. So she was exposed to middle school, and her friends, I think one of her friends read the series of books, and so she didn't read them, but she watched the Netflix show. And I just remember, I can't remember what I said, and then she kind of spoiled the ending, the last episode for me. She's like, she basically said, he's telling the truth.
Yeah.
And so
he's definitely not like a traditional writer mm-hmm. in that respect. What I appreciate about him is he kind of dives into philosophy a lot, and it's a lot of understanding people in general
mm-hmm.
but he made a point in these books to showcase how often adults don't listen to children. So he really wanted to create a world where, in this case, these three children are generally adept and able to figure things out, and yet
yeah.
when they tell the truth, the adults don't listen.
And so I don't remember, I'm pretty sure I said this in our Harry Potter episode, and that is something I think that I'm not a fan of.
No, I get it.
And so when I come across that in writing, especially children's stuff, not to say that that people don't ignore children, but I don't believe we live in a society quite like that anymore.
Well, and I think because this is a world outside of our own.
Correct. So it's an area in which I'm very torn because yeah. I was a very different father, yeah. I guess, than most other, you know, a lot of parents around me.
Mm-hmm.
But it's funny, now that we're talking about this, I can think of a handful of parents where some of them are very involved in their kids' lives and others are not. So I get it. Yeah. I can see.
Later on in the series, and mm-hmm. there's always certain people that they come across who kind of are good and listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
Inevitably, the plot will take those characters out.
Yeah.
But I find that in these books, once they start to get to know real agents of VFD,
mm-hmm.
the agents of VFD are the ones who are very cultural and well-rounded and literate and worldly and so on and so forth. But they're the ones who are trying to keep like the good things in life alive.
Okay.
And you find that most people in the books, as I would say most people in life in general, are just yeah. mundane.
Yeah.
And happy being...
That's funny you
happy
said
Happy being low. And like happy where they're at, you know? And so VFD in the books, they work as an exaggerated cultural phenomena almost,
yeah.
like a light in the world, trying to keep things going. And so they're the ones who are very supportive and understanding and encouraging of the children.
Mm, okay. And that makes more sense. See, it's funny. That's why I love this podcast, because we get, when you bring to light the aspects that I either missed or not aware of because I didn't finish the series,
mm-hmm.
it makes more sense.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, would you recommend these books to children?
One of the things I can say as a parent is I get trying to shield your kid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But once I think my kid hit maybe about fifth, sixth grade, I made sure to have all the important conversations.
Yeah.
And now she's gone to college, so I'm hoping everything worked out.
Yeah.
So with that, I made sure, even in the movies we watched and the things like that, I did not shield her, but I wanted her to be aware of what the world around mm-hmm. her. And I think in reading this book, because I did think about that. I thought about, you know, my wife watched the Netflix series with me, and she's like, I think it was yesterday, she said something like, do you realize like there's a hint of darkness to it where Count Olaf is killing someone? Pretty much every book, if not, you know.
Oh yeah.
And so it's
in the books, he's very evil.
Yeah. And so it's of course I would always say to you have to know the kid, and you have to know what they can what they can handle, what's good for them and stuff. But in the grand scheme of things, I think for a kid, I might. It makes for a better way of talking to children about how the world looks.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting about A Series of Unfortunate Events, when you look at the world in general,
mm-hmm.
like I said, you encounter most people and it's just mundane.
Yeah.
But I would say it's a ridiculously simple world.
Yes.
In that things are, for the most part, very black and white
mm-hmm.
until they're not, and then it throws things into chaos.
Mm-hmm.
But like all the adults, it's very much like, this is the way it works, this is how we're doing it, and you find out very quickly how many adults are just stupid.
Yeah.
And very prideful, which makes it very difficult for the children.
Yeah.
And so that's why, you know, the characters of VFD become very interesting when you do look into them, because on one hand, they are the ones keeping society afloat. They're the ones in helping people to grow and to become better and encourage artistic endeavors and mm-hmm. so on and so forth.
Yeah.
And keep the peace and structure and so on. But then the flip side of that, like I said, is are they also just controlling things?
Mm-hmm.
Which obviously the other side of the schism is. But
yeah. And I think it adds more realism to how, because one of the things I'm very big proponent of is that the world is a lot more complex than people really want it to be. And I like what you said before, there is a lot of mundaneness in our world that we, mm-hmm. our minds tend to gloss over, you know?
Yeah.
Or we don't realize it is. So I think for that reason, I would recommend the series.
Yeah. Well, and that's why Daniel Handler wrote the three siblings the way he did.
Mm-hmm.
One, he gave them each different names from different cultures so that it would be more ambiguous on where the story is set.
Mm-hmm.
But then he gave them specific characteristics that characterize them
mm.
that are a little, especially for the time it was written, counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
Because for Violet, she's an inventor.
Yeah.
And stereotypically, that's more of like a masculine kind mm-hmm. of role or expectation, I should say. And then Klaus is a bookworm. Like, he loves knowledge. He's very into reading and stuff, which, again, for the time period, very stereotypically was very feminine. And then Sunny, as a baby, bites. Like, mm-hmm. she hates soft things. She loves biting things. She loves hard foods and stuff, which is the antithesis of what you expect from a baby.
Correct.
And so he purposefully gave these characteristics to these characters that were contrary to expectation.
Mm.
So that when they encounter the mundane in the mm-hmm. books and the common people and stuff, they stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. And I think that's what kind of draws me to the books a little bit, is that, I don't know if we've talked about this in any of the past episodes, but it's the whole everyone gets a trophy, we're all alike, we're all the same. And it's like, no,
right.
You know, we all bring something different to the table.
Yeah.
And there are some who truly do bring nothing. You know?
Well, especially when you're out for yourself.
Yeah. And that's why I think, in retrospect, as we're discussing it, I kind of wish I would have, you know, it's like, because it was interesting as my daughter was heading off, we had a lot of dinners together, lunches, and that's what I warned her about. I was warning her about, we were going over different types of people, the type of people she's going to meet, people who are out for themselves,
yep.
You know, and that's why I think it, in retrospect, as we're talking about these books, I can see how they would be a great medium of basis for communication about people, but from a fictional perspective, you know?
Yeah. One thing I came across this in my research for this that I found interesting
mm-hmm.
is it was saying that the book sales were moderate at first.
Okay.
And they did okay, but they attribute some of the success of the books, this is a little surprising, but it makes a lot of sense, to a post 9/11 world.
Interesting.
Because they said that the sales started to really pick up and the books did very well after 9/11.
Hmm.
And they said it was because it was teaching children how to cope with loss.
Mm. Okay.
And that's like one of the main features of the book.
Interesting.
It's like these children, the children in the books consistently make the best of bad situations mm-hmm. and don't lose sight of who they are and their love for each other and whoever and all that. But then, you know, they encounter really terrible situations and they persevere, and also handling the death of their parents mm-hmm. and so on.
Yeah.
And so I thought that was interesting.
mm-hmm.
You know, it could be at least a contributing factor.
You could. Yeah. Now you made me kind of want to go back and finish the series.
I will say, if you can get through the Austere Academy, which is the fifth book. Yeah.
Correct, because the Lumbering Mill Mill.
The Miserable Mill.
Miserable Mill.
Yes. That one's the fourth one.
Fourth book.
Yeah, so if you watch the show,
mm-hmm.
where they end up at the end of the first season
mm-hmm.
is the Academy.
Yeah.
Proof Rock Academy.
I saw yeah. the
So that it hints to the next book.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So...
Yeah, I didn't want to go down there too much yet.
Until through that book, it will get a lot more interesting.
Okay.
Because a lot of stuff starts to happen.
Okay.
And more mysteries and things like that.
I'll see if I can squeeze it in my list.
Yeah. It's easier to watch it, I guess, than to read it, but...
Yeah, but I'm the type of, you know... Well, I don't know if this is evident in our podcast. Sometimes I watch things before I read them, but I usually prefer to read it before I watch it.
You definitely do things out of order.
I do, but my preference is to read it. So I kind of wanted to finish reading the books before I continue the series. So we'll see if I get to it. All right. Well, I think that was a hefty conversation on the books. I didn't think we would have that much.
Because you didn't read the later books,
yeah.
So there's some explaining to do in order to understand the adaptations.
True, yeah.
But I think this is going to be a three-part episode.
I think so,
probably.
Too.
Probably.
Mm-hmm.
And so stick around. Next time, we're going to be discussing the 2004 live-action film, the very mm-hmm. first adaptation. And I think we have some interesting to discuss on that one. I will say straight up, it's my favorite, so...
I kind of figured it would be.
Yeah, well, there you go.
All right.
Yep. We will see you next time.
I'll see you next time.
Next time on Willing to Adapt, we will be discussing specifically the 2004 adaptation, the film.
Correct.
The very first one. You know, I don't know why I'm surprised anymore. I shouldn't be surprised. I'll be surprised when you, like, watch something before I did. one of the things that I really appreciate about the film version is its emphasis on family.
It's kind of just glossed over. Oh, children, your parents are dead.
This is one of those weird times where the movie made some big changes, and yet it felt so true to the books at the same time.
Thank you for listening to our podcast, Willing to Adapt.
Please follow or subscribe. Maybe leave a review, or just share us with friends and family.
We would also like it if you would follow us on social media.
If you have ideas for future episodes for us, please email us at ericandromy@willingtoadapt.com.
That's Romy with an I.
And remember, when the only thing constant in life is change, be willing to adapt.